You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I want to apologize for the echo in this podcast, if it exists, because I'm in my very cavernous home. I make a fortune in show business. And there's one man that would probably take all the credit, and that's my father, Mike Callen. And he happens to be on the podcast today, back by popular demand, Big Mike, as you guys know him, because I'm always getting requests for Big Mike when I do my stand-up. So here he is. He's 76. I had my 50th birthday. He came and made a speech, basically insulting me the whole time. It was a roast. But then he told me that he was proud of me. So I finally got the recognition and the love I've been looking for 50 years. And if you people wonder why I walk around like I have a hole I can't fill, well, it's because my father wasn't a good father. There, I said it. Well, he wasn't a loving father, I should say. But thanks for all the money.
Well, you know, if I were suddenly set down with no idea of where I had been set down, could have been the Argentine jungle, it could have been the middle of Paris, I could dismiss all that in a second because I'm in Hollywood. And every time you turn around, there's an explosion of bullshit, and we've just had...
We just had a bit of it. Excuse me.
If there's ever been a devoted father who has doted on his son. The one thing I heard at the speeches that were given, including yours, is that you had always tried in your stand-up to make me laugh.
Yeah.
And that you finally succeeded.
That's right.
Well, I felt that I should control my laughter as uproarious as I wanted it to be inside. I was just hysterical.
I see.
But you then told me that I'm laughing at the wrong parts.
Yeah, you probably are. And that's okay. And
but
I'll
I didn't
trying.
Know that. I would have no. been glad. I felt that if I had laughed, I would have been falling into the Hollywood mode.
I understand. I understand. You know, well, Hunter and I are happy to have you here, and we want to get your take on Donald Trump, who I know you're not a fan of at all, and have never been a fan of, and have some experience with him business-wise, and having worked in New York for as long as you did, and as a person, and probably the things you've heard. And I know you're probably as flabbergasted by his immigration executive order as anybody else, but maybe you could unpack some of this and what we should expect, because you were telling me that the president has broad powers when it comes to executive orders on immigration.
There are several pieces to all this, aren't there? Donald Trump happens to be the president of the United States. The president of the United States, by long-established precedent at the Supreme Court level, based on the Constitution, has enormous executive power. Now, the system is a good one because he's already been reversed or stayed in the courts. So the idiocy that comes out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue will not stand, and eventually the Supreme Court's going to get to it. It's very difficult to find anybody that supports the various pieces of this action.
Well, Fox News says one thing.
And there is nobody who has dealt with Donald Trump when he was a real estate guy in New York. And moi is one of them.
French, guys. My father speaks French. Keep going. We have a huge French audience.
Nobody who has dealt with him would have voted for him. I'm almost certain of that.
I believe that.
Because to have dealt with him is to have known what he really is all about. And this executive order manifests some of the essential points. I don't think the man has ever read anything. But on the other hand, he appears to be a good listener, and that's when he was doing his transactions and deals. You know, there are two types of people, and one of them was somebody I admired greatly in the same business in New York. Alan Tishman has now passed on. Alan Tishman would do a transaction with a large commercial development, would read every page of probably 1,500 to 2,000 pages of legal documentation. He'd read every page. He'd have notes here and there. And to negotiate with him was to spend long hours going through these tedious documents. Donald Trump never read the first page. Yeah. He's just not. He is, by definition, superficial. Now, let's talk about this process, a little background. Just take 2 minutes. Government is all about intent. It's very difficult to find an inaugural address or a State of the Union address you won't agree with. That's when both sides of the aisle in Congress applaud. Yes, we're going to eliminate poverty. Yes, we're going to make our education system the best in the world. And yes, everybody's going to be happy at the end of all this. So we all applaud. It's all about intent. But the results are very close to zero. If you're really, really, really kind, you give it a D minus. So you've got to talk about that huge gap, right, from the great society all the way down through the Trumps. People vote for intent. They don't vote for results. They vote because they're unhappy with the bad results. And so somebody comes along and says, oh, I'll fix all that. And that's what we had this time. And it reaches various degrees, right? It can get intense at times. During the Vietnam War, it was really intense. The Iraq War. By the way, if you look, you see that very often foreign policy events that explode cause a change in our government. Not too often is the domestic issues, because they're too slow to evolve and expand. But Trump was all about intent, and it's embarrassing to the country to see what his statements were in the debates. Mm. They'd be talking about something of substance. And let me give you a quick example you might not remember. In the second debate, they were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that he has just signed an executive order withdrawing the United States from. In the debate, one of the primary debates, in fact, because Rand Paul is the one that called him out on this, he started raging about China. China wasn't part of the TPP. He didn't know that.
Hmm. He's definitely not detail-oriented.
Not only not detail-oriented, he's not even...
aware?
He's not even cosmically aware of what's going on, because he doesn't deal in facts. And you can call him out. There was a speech made that he made, and I think one of the New York Times, David Brooks, who is a conservative columnist from the New York Times, said there were 12 egregious errors of fact in his speech. But the people cheered and yelled.
Well, that's because they were angry. Right? They were angry and they were desperate, and he told them a story that sounded plausible.
We should talk about why Donald Trump became president. Because yeah. I don't think in 1982, when Reagan, no chance that Donald Trump could have become president.
Well, there was still a sanctity to the office. Things were still very formal, and I think people would have been very nervous. There was still sort of, before the internet and reality shows and whatever it was, people were still more idealistic, more formal, had more faith in the presidency, the way they had more faith in a doctor, because a doctor had to be always right. A priest was a priest, would never in a million years molest a child. I remember these things. We were in ways, I know that the 20th century was a horrific time, but you didn't see it. You weren't aware of the detail of the dirt that it took to do things. You weren't aware that your sports heroes might be on steroids. That would make no sense, those kinds of things. I mean, with information comes a loss of innocence. And I think that might have been something.
I think you're baiting me, because you know I have a very different view. I don't think the world has ever been better.
No, I agree with you.
I mean, in all respects. So, I mean, when I hear people
talk along the lines you just did,
all I have to do is think back to 1960, 70, 80, 90, and we were in deep kimchi in many cases.
Yes.
1962, I'll never forget. If you were alive in 1962, and I don't think anybody in this room was, very few people listening were, but that was a Cuban Missile Crisis, and you have to understand the tension in the society at large. By the way, it would be very interesting, just as a little token of appreciation of what those times are like, go back and get any newspaper you wish, from the Milwaukee Journal to the New York Times in October of 1962. There was nothing. I don't mean the fashion section, the entertainment section, or any of that. They didn't even publish those sections for about 12 to 13 days. It was all about that crisis, because we really, really believed that the missiles were going to be launched and we were about to suffer a nuclear holocaust. And I am a skeptic on things like that. I try very hard not to rise to these kinds of this kind of hype.
And it
this,
was only 17 this, only 17 years after World War II.
This wasn't
well.
Hype.
No.
Right? This was not hype. I was a 22-year-old kid, and like everybody else at the university, I was going to be called back into the Marine Corps, which I had just gotten out of. But if there was anything to fight over, right?
So yeah, no kidding. Scary times.
That's a high point of bad times. There has never been a time in my lifetime that I was conscious where you weren't finding all of these people calling for the end of the world, and especially now when you have so many microphones, podcasts we didn't have. Mm-hmm. You didn't have all the cable TV and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and all the rest of them. If that's where you get your news, even in background when you have the TV on, how can it not affect you? Unless you have my kind of perspective.
But I think that's the key thing, Uncle Mike, is that everybody has a microphone now, and so someone like you does get the opportunity to share their perspective, and then those perspectives can compete. And, you know, what's happened to what Brian is saying is that it wasn't that people weren't doing things in the 60s. You know, Kennedy slept with everybody. And, you know, the only difference was that in Bill Clinton's time, that dirty laundry was aired out. And I don't think that the airing out of dirty laundry is bad. I think that a family is only as sick as its secrets. And what's awkward is the process of beginning to air out that dirty laundry. But once the laundry is out, we all feel much better when we've addressed all the elephants in the room.
And this executive order on immigration is a gesture, and it's consistent with how this man's behaved his entire life. There has never been any substance in almost anything he's done. He didn't write the Art of the Deal, the book. He didn't write it. I doubt he even read it. But he did say early on, it's the greatest business book ever written, which is only – that would be a minor – sin in terms of the outrageous statements he's made. So my position on this, we can talk about the specifics of this executive order. My position is nobody can last using the techniques and engaging in the behavior he is engaging in. And the bets among people whose intellect and experience and age and everything I respect around where I'm living is whether or not he can last 4 years.
Yes.
This is my dear friend Jed Minoff. Go ahead. This is a salon. Go on, Jed.
Many questions. But let me just ask you one, Mike. That is what everybody said about Trump as the candidate. There's no way he can win. And with every outrageous thing that he said, the reaction from the media was, well, this is going to bring him down. And yet it just kept accelerating his ultimate victory. How is this, now that he's president, different from how he was able to perform and succeed as a candidate?
Well, his promises will start to fail and fall under their own weight, and that's not going to be forgiven. I think, Jed, that leads us to why are we where we are with a man that many describe as a moron writ large that no one wants to defend. I mean, we're in the hotbed of the People's Democratic Republic of California, so you wouldn't expect to find anybody here that would vote for Trump. But
that's a reference for you young people to the fact that California is essentially communist. Keep
close,
going, Mike. And
close.
It's important to realize, by the way, caveat, that Trump has very low ratings, personal ratings. People even that voted for him in the red states don't like him necessarily as a person, but they like what he's doing. And the majority of the population, according to the polls by Fox News, support his ban on Muslim, you know, majority nations, 57% or something like that. But
it cannot stand. The courts will defeat it, and that's what makes this country worthwhile. To Jed's point, why are we where we are? Why did Donald Trump win? There are always several reasons. One of them, in my view, is I am one of many people I know who were ABH voters, anybody but Hillary. I didn't vote for Trump, But I understand why people would not want anything to do with Clinton. And in my personal view, her ethical baggage was enough to weigh down a freight train. And I think there isn't much question she's one of these people. Is he the narcissist who needs serious help in a confined environment? She is a congenital liar who contrives everything she ever said. And people are not dumb, you know, the wisdom of crowds kind of thing. I think if she hadn't been up against him, if she had been up against somebody decent, I think she would have been buried. And it turns out electorally she was. I mean, it's amazing that he won the states he won to get into the presidency. But what I think the overall problem is, besides Hillary, is the fact that we have been promised so much through this intent syndrome of an administrative state. And there's a huge fallacy in this, goes all the way back to Johnson and Kennedy, where you get the smartest people you can get, i.e. Harvard professors, and anybody who's ever gone to Harvard, there may even be some people within earshot at the moment, really do believe they're superior intellects. And if you're on the faculty of Harvard, that's the world has just voted you into a superior intellectual. And we'll get back to that in a second. But people have been promised, and the Obama administration bought into this. Their philosophy was four square behind it, that you get a bunch of really smart people, and they administer everybody else's life. And they come up with all these great ideas, and there's nothing wrong with the way they sound, and that's why they survive. But it's always at the end, we need a few good men in the Kremlin. That's where it always comes down to that. So they go to the Harvard faculty.
More communist, more Russian / communist.
So you get a few good men who are going to administer this whole state. And they pretty soon they're telling you how you talk, what pronouns you can use, how much water you can have in a toilet flush, how much water you can have coming out of your shower. And, you know, it's insidious. It goes on and on and on. But when you look at the overall results, and I love this statistic. I've used it on the podcast before, and it's still one of the most important. I'll give you two statistics which I think tell a huge story. One, where you have competition in the private sector, which is what we all condemn but we love because we use their iPhones, we use their computers, we use their pharmaceuticals, all the rest of it. In 1955, when Fortune magazine, my son's heard this many times, when Fortune magazine came out with the first list of the top 500 companies. And top 500, and John Kenneth Galbraith, names that are no longer common. Every college student in my day had to read Galbraith's books because he was saying, these companies are running our lives and we've got to do something about it, i.e. replace them with government. Talk about running your lives. Well, there's only 61 of those original 500 left. Where'd they all go? They all went the way of competition. And today we have companies like Yahoo. In those days, we had companies that people won't remember anymore. Sinclair Oil, go through a list. General Motors went broke. If it hadn't been for government, they wouldn't even exist anymore. We had four major sellers of cars. Today we have some 26 sellers of cars, including the car my son drives, a Tesla. Which government bureau did that come out of? I don't remember. But you can't name one government agency that ever went out of business. Not even one. They don't exist. Now, one other statistic. So that's one. The private sector, it's incredible competition. When you talk to the left, i.e. California, you have people that are convinced of a conspiracy theory. All these guys, and I was one of them, get together in a room and they say, let's screw the little people and get rich ourselves. That's some incredible belief and some mythology of people that believe that. And what you're really talking about is competition on a daily basis, fighting like mad to present better value to the consumer, because if you don't, you're going out of business. You're on your way down, and somebody is going to come and take over for you. There is no competition in government. Now, what that results in is, in 1970, here's another number for you, about 70-some percent of the American public said, I have faith in government. I think they're going to do the right thing. That number is down to 9% in the early 1915 Gallup did the same poll. It went from 70-something to 9. Well, I'm not surprised. I don't think anybody should be. Because what they voted Donald Trump in over the establishment is that the administrative state telling us how to live, telling us where we can work, telling us everything about our lives in great detail, doesn't work. And that's the problem with skepticism on global warming. People say, yeah, is it getting warm? I was cold as hell walking home last night, but I guess maybe if you smart people say that. But wait a minute, what do you want to do? You want to take over more of my life to fight this giant threat that's going to encompass us any day? People aren't buying it. You've got a tough road to hoe if you're a government official trying to tell them that there's some danger and that it will be all solved if you just give us more power. That's a hard sell.
Well, I think, Uncle Mike, firstly, you know, you've assailed the integrity of my alma mater, and I think that's utterly appropriate because it's gone to shit and has done a whole lot of damage in the world, which is why I've had a break from Rome or Cambridge, and I've actually been talking to your son about burning my college degree publicly to symbolize that. But I think the thing that I would say is that this all comes back down to the breakdown of authority and the rebellion against experts, which is really what 2016 was about, is that the people may not know all the things that are happening in academia, but they understand that the promises of economists aren't delivering prosperity for them. They know something is broken. They don't necessarily know how to fix it. And the mistake I think that scientists make and academics make is that they try and continue to try and rely on their authority. So they say, oh, you know, 97% of scientists believe in climate science. And I think that authority is gone. I think that you're never going to get authority back and that you just have to teach the controversy and you have to rely on breaking down the facts and explaining them clearly and that the people are smart enough to decide for themselves. The wisdom of crowds is there. It just needs to be stoked.
And another point of this 97% I hear all the time, without getting into climate science, we have other things to talk about. Statement was made on Face the Nation, mm-hmm. or some program like that, by a New York Times columnist who is not a scientist, mm-hmm. who is an opinion maker. And he said 97% of all scientists. That's never been tested, never been checked. If that were ever presented in a court of law, the guy would be diced up and carried out in several pieces because there is no accurate source of data that can demonstrate 97%. It's an echo chamber. Somebody said on television 97% and everybody else started talking about that.
And even if the 97% were true, that's an appeal to authority. It's a classic logical fallacy, and that's not what science is supposed to be about. Science is supposed to be about the evidence and letting the evidence speak for itself. But what we have now is we have a professional cadre of high priests who tell us what to think and what not to think, rather than saying, hey, you're smart. I can break this thing down for you. You can make your own decision. Democracy.
Well, intellectual democracy, which you've been talking about for a long time. The idea that everyone, and I think Hunter's very ambitious, and he's been creating this whole Twitter storm, which has actually pissed off Rogan and Sam Harris. And I've scolded him about it because I don't think it's probably the best way to go about it, which we're going to get into in the next podcast. But I do think that you're very passionate about getting the important ideas into the heads of people that don't read, into the heads of, for lack of a better word, the rednecks, the hillbillies, the ghetto kids, whoever it is. I mean, there are so many people that are not exposed. Not only are they not exposed to the important ideas, but they don't have the benefit of somebody to break them down, mm-hmm. to make them less intimidating, to make them accessible, digestible, and usable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's good luck with that, because that would require that people actually read. But I think at least the podcast, at least you're trying to create enough energy and conflict around the podcast that people have to pay attention.
Also, crucially, though, I don't think it does necessarily require people to read, because a lot of these things you can see in your everyday life. So, for example, if I want to talk to you about evolution, I don't have to make you read a whole bunch of books on genetics. I can point you to your dog, because you can read your dog's facial expressions. So how are you able to interpret your dog's facial expressions? Because you come from the same evolutionary lineage, right? So evolution is all around you, and that's what your dad was talking about before with Matt Ridley. You know, everything is evolution. So literally the entire universe is, and what we're going through now is an evolutionary process where we're reaching the end of a cycle. You know, there's the unity of that World War II brings about, and then there's an increasing disunity. right? You know, there's a lack of that asabiyya that Ibn Khaldun talked about, the energy that binds a community together, which comes through conflict. And so now, the either what's going to happen is, like Mikhail Gorbachev says, we're either preparing for a great war, or we have a great war of ideas. And we are bound together in, you know, wrestling and challenging with ideas. It's either going to be jihad or ijtihad. And that's the choice.
Interesting. Hunter wants to create a scientific reformation, and he wants me to be part of it. I don't know anything about science. I'm not prepared for a reformation. I'm too goddamn busy. But you, the Hunter was explaining that the new atheists, and I don't know if this is a fair characterization, but that a lot of the new atheists, like Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, tend to have a perspective of, well, they're looking at the human mind in a very sort of outdated mode, where human beings have always been given the credit of being way more rational than they are emotional, or at least emotion and rationality are supposed to be separated. But the new science suggests that your emotions drive your thinking, regardless of who you are. And you've got to become very aware that you have it's the thinking fast and slow thing, that you have a fast brain and a slow brain. You have fast thinking and slow thinking, and your fast thinking is influenced by your behavior, your past, your belief system, your trauma, your victory, where you feel comfortable, where you don't feel comfortable. And that will lead to confirmation bias. That will lead you to even to be able to see the things that you want to see and not see the things you don't want to see. And
yeah, but none of this is really new, right?
Right.
I mean, if you've lived, as I have, 76 years, there are certain advantages just to the time elapsing.
You've always talked this way a little bit, yeah.
Well, I mean, because I had the benefit by luck, and it's not something that you can seek out because you're not aware of the need, but by luck to have some really, really wise people at various points in my life, including the Marine Corps, by the way, that taught me different lessons. And I've never seen any evidence to suggest that those lessons were invalid. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, there's always a very concise way of putting things. Would you rather be governed by the Harvard faculty, going back to them again? You could use Yale.
They're all cut from the same bad cloth.
But you'd have to decide. Would you rather be governed by the Harvard faculty or by the first 2,000 people in the Boston telephone directory? And if you've got to really think about that, because we had the Harvard faculty in the Kennedy administration, and they were carried over to the Johnson administration, and the Great Society, and a very good lesson for anybody that is currently, at, say, about your age. You guys are, you just turned middle age by definition, I guess, at 50.
Hold on. Let's just back up for a sec. I am, yeah, okay.
This isn't all about you, Brian.
No, I know
is
that.
No,
you could say middle good. Age as in but my body,
your body is.
I'm as elastic as I am.
Let me say, you said I'm a bad father, but I want to make sure everybody understands your body is what it is.
I was looking for some. God damn it, all the work I do. All right, the point is, be careful with throwing around the word 50 like I'm a regular 50-year-old. Keep going.
You're not a regular 50.
Thank you.
Chronologically, I remember the day in the Philippines.
Yeah,
the nurse came out. In those days, you couldn't go into the delivery room, certainly not in the Philippines, in 1967. And the nurse came out and said, "I'm sorry."
Well, that's it?
No, she said, "It's a boy."
I remember it well. Jesus, got me worried. Well. Sorry.
No, look, what I was going to say, if you want to do something and spend a little time without going into the great tomes that the great intellects read, go back, and it's very easy to do with the internet available to us. Go back and read some of the speeches by the Kennedys and the Johnsons, particularly the Johnson and that administration. This guy Califano and a lot of the other great intellects we all adored and got on our knees when they came on television, and see what they were telling us the society was going to become under their programs, under this great revolution called the Great Society. Poverty was going to be eliminated. It's going to be gone. Mm-hmm. Now, read the speeches.
I hear you, and I believe that.
Just one last point on that. Now look at the campaign rhetoric that we're debating with Clinton and any recent campaign and Trump, and it's the same speeches.
Yeah.
It's the same problems, except that since 1965, and I was present when Johnson signed the poverty program, the anti-poverty program. I went to Washington, and I was there, and I cheered and yelled and all the rest of it. But we have since then spent, at the three levels of government, $3 trillion, $3,000 billion to eliminate poverty. And if you ask poor people or politicians who are arguing and campaigning on anti-poverty platforms, what's the $3 trillion done for the poor?
Right. Well, let's switch gears for a sec, because we've covered that a lot in terms of, you know, you don't like big government. And
well, what am I? I'm redundant now?
No. But I wanted to actually get to what you, Hunter, I want to get my father's take on this, because Hunter's waging this war on the new atheists, or at least trying to create a controversy. And I wanted you to kind of maybe reiterate what your problem is with... My guess is your problem with a lot of the leaders of thought in the new atheist movement is that they're not good bridge builders. They're not good at moving ideas, because they are, as you said, with friends like Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, science doesn't need enemies.
Well, my problem is Big Mike's problem, which is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. There's a whole bunch of people who have a lot of fine principles where, you know, the new atheists oppose violence. You know, the Great Society was about eliminating poverty. Donald Trump is going to make America great again. And all these things sound fantastic. But, you know, there's a big difference between hope and a dream and a plan. And a plan needs to be grounded in reality. And, you know, as I came to understand reality. I did not live in reality in 2004 when I graduated from Harvard, as Big Mike will tell you very clearly. I was lost in my head. And then, you know, I sort of slowly came back to ground, partly through having to work and tutor and work with kids and sort of understand that, and partly through reading the science, and partly from understanding that all science has done is rediscover a lot of old lessons, very timeless wisdom that has existed, and that people like drill instructors know. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, you can wade through, like, I'm focused on the science with Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins because supposedly that's what they respect and that's what they respond to. But they're for the audience, and this is why you don't actually have to read these books, it comes down to very practical things, where if you want to, you know, if you want to have an exchange of ideas with a culture, there needs to be respect, there needs to be trust, there needs to be mutual understanding, and you need to affirm the other people's principles. So, you know, your dad can tell you all about what it's like to work with Arabs and how much trade is there going to be if on the first day you come in and say your whole religion, your whole culture, your whole history is shit. You need to get rid of it, or you need to pull out a bunch of pieces. That's not the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yeah, Big Mike, your thoughts on that?
Again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, and I hope this comes to an end, because that gets a little boring. But atheism is certainly not new, right? And the arguments behind it are shop-worn.
You're an atheist. You're an atheist.
I would never describe myself as an atheist, because that's too arrogant. Call me an agnostic. And I traveled from being a fervent Catholic in a seminary before I ever thought of you. I didn't even know where babies came from those days. But I've never heard, and we in the seminary, people wouldn't believe it, in the Catholic seminary, you looked at all the arguments for atheism and even acknowledged that some of them were valid, because if you're going to try to deal with us on a platform of logic, you're going to run into a brick wall. But there are people, the main thing for me about this religion issue is that the entire society is based on it. It's changing, yes, but we exaggerate how much it's changing, because it's not just going to church and saying I believe in God, doing a certain prayer. It's everything behind that and underneath that we live with on a daily basis. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. Mm-hmm. None of us to say that. Thou shalt honor thy mother and father, by the way.
Yes,
that happens to be number 7.
Right. Gotcha.
Spend a little time on that. But our laws, just the laws, and There's another point. I've gone through this again, but I really think it's worthwhile because it guides my life, and you got me on here, so I'm going to tell you real quickly. The four boxes. Think about the four boxes again and why people disagree and why you can't get along together. And the box one over here on the right is behavior. So if you punch Hunter right now, Jed and I, and if your mother were here, we'd say, hey, I think I can – we'll all describe that similarly. Brian punched Hunter. We heard a story yesterday of a friend we all have who committed an act. There can't be much difference in versions of it. That's the first thing. The second box over is the feelings that cause the punch. And I think we could even agree on that. That can get more complicated, by the way. But in my example, you were feeling anger and frustration to an extreme degree, so you punched it. One box over, perception. There was something you perceived that generated that feeling, and then to cut this short, you go back to the last box and the furthest on the left, and that's the important one. That's the assumptions you carry around all your life. You may not even be aware of it, but you talked about the Arab world. Their assumptions are distinctly different but very well defined. Mm-hmm. Don't go into an Arab or an Islamic environment and start talking about atheism and talking about the evolutionary process of life and how the Big Bang started. Don't talk about that because you're talking to somebody's fundamental assumptions that defines exactly who they are from childhood. And you can call out a problem, the world's going to come to an end because of it, whatever you wish, but that's a fact.
That's human beings.
And their perceptions are based on that assumption. Hmm. So, for example, in Saudi Arabia, they have a whole lot of oil, and they don't have to work real hard. You know, the old saying is they think manual labor is a Spanish explorer. It's not part of the. You know, it's not. And but that is because God deigned them to have all this oil wealth on the ground, so that they could focus all of their wealth and energy on spreading the word of God, Allahu Akbar. That God is great. Mm. You will not convince many. There may be one or two that did go to Harvard, in fact, and I knew some. If you live there, you're going to. They won't entirely buy into that. But that's basically the assumption underlying everything that drives their behavior. Flying airplanes into buildings, and we wonder how people could do that. We got to kill them all, is the attitude of some Paleolithic types that are around now. But even the assumptions in this country, like in California, you know, when you know, what are you marching for? We're going to get the United States out of North America, you know, and you go to where I am and you've got people that want to abolish stop signs. But you look back into the fundamental assumptions that they carried around since childhood, and that's what takes this to that behavior of being out there and screaming and yelling. Mm.
And so that's interesting. If you want to change that behavior, part of what you have to do is create an environment where people are comfortable bringing out those fundamental assumptions, looking at them, reexamining them. And, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, tutoring is about. It's about establishing an environment with the right climate where people are, A, first have to be aware of them, because very often they're not even aware of them, right? They sit under your subconscious. And then, B, once they're out in the open, then you can unpack them and deal with them.
And I would like to make a prediction about Trump's executive order.
Yeah.
It will not stand. Could be wrong. Hope I'm not. The reason I'm saying that is there may be people on TV, especially on these talk shows, that will be standing up there and supporting and screaming and yelling. They make good for ratings. I think the main body, even outside of the People's Democratic Republic here, the main body across the country have a very deep-seated feeling that this is wrong and this is contrary
to American
how they
values.
Identify themselves as Americans. Yeah. And I think the courts are going to reflect that. I think the House first and the Senate second will reflect that. And I think you're going to find when we don't know what's going on now with the communications with the White House, but I think the Wall Street Journal's latest news section on the web said that they're scrambling to try to find a way out of this mess they've created. And I don't think it's going to stand. I mean, no one man in this country has that kind of power.
Yeah.
Also, because Donald Trump is fighting very old culture. You know, he rode into power on the back of the Scotch-Irish, right, the rednecks. And the nature of that culture is that they kneel to no man. and they're not going to put up with an authoritarian leader. They haven't put up with an authoritarian leader in hundreds and hundreds of years.
Ooh, that's an interesting take. Jed, you had a question again. Jed Minoff, ladies and gentlemen. Jed Minoff, part of our forum.
Thank you. Mike, say what you want about Donald Trump, and I have no good feelings about him. But my sister brought up something interesting, who's maybe even more left than I am. Is that she said that, you know, he's doing what she would do if she was put into a position of authority and she didn't like how things were done before. And if she had the power to just make decisions unilaterally and say it's going to be done differently. And it got me thinking that he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And a lot of people said, well, we'll see. This was the campaign rhetoric, and he's going to get in there, and he's really a moderate. But in fact, he's doing precisely what he said he's going to do. He's actually being true to his word. And I'm wondering if you think that he believes that what he's doing is actually going to work, or it doesn't even matter. Because as long as he's doing what he said he's going to do, and he really has nothing to lose, he's not going to have to run for another office after this. He's a multi-billionaire. So it doesn't work. He goes back to what he was doing before and continues to make money.
Well, I am not going to try to take his psyche apart, but I will say, Jed, that we are speaking to the yawning gap between campaigning and governing. And what we have found already is his campaign rallies were one thing, and a lot of people that I don't think were thinking hard about it rallied to his cause. But when he, for example, signed this executive order, he discovered that the hurry to do it in a campaign style has resulted in all kinds of problems they clearly had not anticipated. The salient example is that they included people who had green cards, which they legally cannot do. And by the way, without going into it, on his executive orders, and he signed five of them, if you follow.
By the way, and soldiers who had fought for our country for 10 years, interpreters and things like that. That's
the most egregious case. The people he's blocking have been vetted beyond any amount of vetting you could possibly do. They work for the United States. None of this was thought about. It was all a campaign gesture. Let's have another cheer. The man is clearly intoxicated by crowds shouting for him. And I think that's part of the psyche of a narcissist. And that'll all work itself out. I mean, the people are going to get very tired of that very soon. But I guess my point would be that if he doesn't understand the forces arrayed against him and how they can be very powerful within the halls of government, You can fairly easily, and we have this in even recent history, thwart the intentions of a president. And once he starts losing credibility, and that, by the way, and government is read as polls, it's like in a business losing market share. Nothing can focus the mind and get rid of a CEO faster than being clearly losing market share to a competitor. That's when the board picks up, and it's a very difficult meeting. And I've been in two of them where the boss has literally been fired at the board meeting. And it's a very final, there's no sympathy, it's all very ruthless because this is life and death. It's a little different in government. The principle is the same. When his polls keep deteriorating and they find that his so-called base is beginning to run and desert because they can't defend what he's doing, and that his very act of trying to get a roar from the crowd is getting a loud boo, you're going to find a very different environment. I think we have got one. And the press will do its job.
Unless the economy is doing really well.
Yeah, I don't even believe that. And by the way, this is something we should focus a little bit on. If he does everything he said he's going to do, Jed, you're going to have higher prices, higher unemployment. If we cut back significantly on trade, we're going to put rafts of highly skilled people out of work, people who are politically active, and a whole bunch of bad things happen. And you can't believe that he's thought about any of it. Because if he just all you have to do is look at his campaign. And I don't even like being here and charging one candidate for everything from Hitler to Mussolini. But if you just look at his campaign and look at his debate performance, there wasn't any substance that came out of anything he said. It was all to exaggerate. I'm over the top here. It was all hate, 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 hate. And, you know, Jeb Bush, who didn't get anybody's attention, not even his own wife, did say one thing at one point, which I thought was pretty much all of it. He said, you can't insult your way into the White House. We have discovered you can if you have a set of circumstances around you. And one of those circumstances, in my opinion, was Hillary Clinton. A machine person, a contrived person, part of the old world. And the globalization has left a lot of people disenfranchised.
Well,
so they weren't going to vote for Hillary.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton was Marie Antoinette. Like, in the middle of a revolution, they ran someone from the Ancien Régime.
Yeah, we haven't taken her head off yet. I wouldn't support having her executed. Yeah.
But I think the other thing too, Uncle Mike, is in terms of, you know, history repeating itself, we've already done protectionism. That was mercantilism. Like these ideas of, you know, isolating countries and sort of having protected markets is the oldest idea in the world, and it doesn't keep wealth in the country. It just makes everybody poorer, because trade is how we create prosperity.
Trade has created prosperity.
Yeah, you said a lot of the people that have benefited from globalism.
These microphones we're using, I can guarantee you, there are component parts from all over the world that went into them.
That's right.
The equipment you use.
That's right. Well, he can't be that unsophisticated. He's got to know. My feeling is that the question is, isn't he listening to the people around him?
Well, did he even – let's take this executive order. It is so clearly done in a big hurry to make a big bang – from the publicity standpoint, it would be difficult to convince me that very many intelligent people looked at this, vetted it, and discussed it because of the nature of who he is and how he operates. I've got a great idea. Write it up. This is what we're going to say. This is what I said I'd do in the campaign. I've signed it and sent it out. And then all the problems started to hatch. The government has never done that way. The last time anything like that was done is when Bill Clinton pardoned
Mike Rich, yeah.
No, what the hell? I'm forgetting.
Jeff Rich.
He's dead now, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. But he was in Switzerland who was convicted of a $335 million tax fraud.
Didn't he give money to
Mark Rich. He managed Hillary's money. The whole thing was so corrupt.
Well, he pardoned Hillary, and I think that his wife gave money to the Hillary campaign.
He divorced Denise immediately, who then became the source of all kinds of funding, spent God knows how many nights in the Lincoln bedroom in the White House. I mean, the thing stunk from top to bottom. And Bill would excuse himself about 11:30 and come back at about 2:30 exhausted. And I wonder if he was doing state business or some other kind of business. And, you know, Denise is in the bedroom, and she was around him, giving him saxophones at various dinners, and it was just an egregious, disgusting mess. The divorce between her and her husband Mark Rich was contrived to avoid legal liability on her part, so she could stay in the United States. And then he pardons him on the last day in office. It's a Clinton operation, and they shouldn't get any more trust. By the way, just interesting. Somebody predicted this, but we all say that the Clinton Global Institute was peddling influence because she was Secretary of State.
Look at
was
the Uranium
be president
One
and all
deal
that.
And stuff, yeah.
They folded it up, which you saw in the press.
I didn't see that.
They folded it up because they can't raise any more money. I wonder why, from all these foreign governments. Why do you think these foreign governments were giving them money because of the good work they were doing? Yeah. And they weren't doing bad work. But you think that's why they were getting the money?
Yeah.
I don't think so somehow. And the fact that they can't raise another dime and had to fold the thing up as soon as she lost the presidency, is that coincidental?
That's amazing.
But I think also what's really important to note about the way that someone like Big Mike thinks is that he pays attention to behavior, not tribe. So he's upset by corruption among the Clintons, and he's upset by the behavior of a Republican like Trump. So it's about behavior and conduct, and he universalizes those principles rather than having special treatment for one group or the other.
That's a very good point. That would be somebody who looks at the evidence and judges people by their actions, not by
like the evidence what of what a great father I've been.
I was going to say,
but that's so overwhelming.
I know. I appreciate it. Joe Rogan was at my birthday party, and he doesn't understand my relationship with my father, which is generally roasting each other. And Joe is like, your father was talking about lending you money, man, in front of all those people. I got a little protective over you. I didn't really like that. I said, you protected me from my father. And did you not see that we have a great relationship there? Yeah, I know. I just, it's my default. It was very endearing. It was very touching that he was being protective. And then I told him how you beat me a lot, even still. Well, listen, I think we've unpacked a lot here. And I hope everybody wrote this stuff down. What is your prediction for the wall that he seems to want to build? Because I'm so against that. It just makes no sense to me. As if they won't tunnel underneath it. The wall. He wants to build a wall.
I think you have to look for a lot of bobbing and weaving. We've got this concept you've heard a lot about, political capital and where you're going to spend it.
Yeah.
He's just wasted huge amounts of it. He may not have any more to spend. So to build a wall, whatever he does to make Mexico pay requires congressional approval if they're going to put some kind of an export tax.
But the country, a lot of countries seems to want this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I know. The part of the country you hear about, the people, and there are a lot of them in Park City, that don't like those who don't look like them. In other words, their skin's a funny color and they speak a different language and all that. And you and I were never raised in that. And I think the country, by and large, doesn't buy into that except for the high, loud voices that are heard during a campaign season. And I don't think it's got legs.
I don't know if that's fair about Trump supporters, because they also did vote for Obama, too. A lot of them did.
So. Yeah. And they come to this whole issue and say, build a wall sounds like a good idea to me. Trump now has to go to the Congress and get tens of billions of dollars, right? Yes. And do you think that the United States Senate is going to be able to muster a majority? I don't.
No.
Not for a wall.
Not for a wall.
And not when they pay for the wall with this stupid promise. I mean, the whole thing is so stupid. We're going to make the Mexicans pay, and the Mexicans give us a huge middle finger, which is exactly what they should do.
Well, that's what they did.
And by the way, let's put some facts in here. In the last 4 years, I think you guys would know there's been a net outflow of Mexicans back to their
country.
It's definitely
fallen. And Mexican immigration has fallen definitely. A great deal.
But the idea is you go to Congress and you say, all right, I want $20 billion for my wall. And all of a sudden, you're going to find bobbing and weaving in the sense that, well, we're going to make a big part of this wall electronic.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was all that Big Mike had time for. That's the nature of wisdom, folks. Can't be squeezed into 140 characters, and it can't be squeezed into a one-hour interview. Needless to say, Big Mike might come back on his own son's show. We don't know. International relations calls, businesses must be run, and the world must be held together by a bear of a man. Thanks so much for tuning in, and keep fighting the good fight, mixed mental artists.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.